is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, the Chinese stock market dropped more than 8% today. This is fascinating stuff. There are a bunch of like warning signs, like a danger, Will Robinson, that are flashing. I don't personally think that these are like immediate risks to us here in the United States. The Dow is down about 100 points, which is not that big a deal. But I think that systemically, you know, economic system wide, we are at a place right now that's not that different from this point in time in 2007. Which is, you've got an election, a presidential election year coming up in the next year, and you've got a bunch of leading indicators that are pointing to a recession, if not a depression. And the government, in this case, the government of China, but also the Fed, you know, everything from quantitative easing to just keeping interest rates so low, is doing everything they can to just hold off the crash until after the election. Which is why I titled my book "The Crash of 2016." I'd be surprised if it happens this year, but I would not be shocked. But if November 2016 comes and we have not had a really significant economic crisis in the United States, it will happen within a few months after the election. In my opinion, I could be totally wrong on this, but. This is the Guardian today wrote in under the headline. Well, actually, this is a Reuters piece. China stock market hit by biggest one-day fall since 2007. Now, those of you who have been long-term listeners of this program will remember back in 2007, I did two things on this program and on the local program that I was doing on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. I was doing a three-hour local program followed by the three-hour national program all out of the same studio there in Portland for about 5 years. And in 2007, we had several of these, everybody was buying real estate. You'd see these things stapled to telephone poles, you know, come to this seminar, learn how to make a fortune in real estate. Because, you know, anybody could buy real estate and turn it into a rental property and watch the equity grow over time and all this kind of stuff. And everybody was jumping in and it was like, you know, it's just like the old story of, you know, fill in the blank said 1929 that he was going to get out of the market because the shoeshine boy was giving him stock tips. And back in 2007, I did two things. The first was I pointed out that in the first or second quarter, I forget which, I think it might have been the second quarter of 2007, we had an over 30% drop in housing starts. And just by coincidence, I had been reading a history of the Great Depression. And it pointed out that the Great Depression really started with a fall in housing starts. Down in Florida, it started out, and then it spread nationwide. It became contagious. And that then led the following year. This is 1928 that happened. And in 1929, of course, it caught up to the stock market. So we'll get to that in just a second. And, you know, I said that. So number one, I pointed that out on the air, and I said, this is a bad sign. And number two, on the local station in Portland that I was on, there were a couple of different mortgage brokers that were advertising with us, and I started refusing to voice their ads, which made management quite unhappy. But I was like, you know, this is not good. You know, these mortgage brokers basically saying, hey, free money, want to buy property? And, of course, what they were doing was they were selling those mortgages to the big banksters at a premium so that they could be turned into derivatives, which, you know, led to the crash. We had a bankster-created crash, and we've got another bankster-created crash on its way. So the Chinese shares dropped 8%. This is, as I said, from Reuters. The Shanghai Composite Index lost 8.5%. Stocks fell across the board. 2,247 companies falling, only 77 gaining. More than 1,500 shares out of the roughly 2,500 shares listed on that Shanghai Composites, Shanghai and Shenzhen Stock Exchange. It's called the CSI 300. Oh, no, that's the index, excuse me. More than 1,500 of these shares dropped 10%, at which point the Chinese government stops trading. Stops the trading. And this just came up. This is in the New York Times. It was posted 9 minutes ago. It's a Reuters story. China's top securities regulator, China Securities Finance Corp. Limited, said on Monday it would continue to buy shares to stabilize the stock market. Now, this is essentially, you know, what we were doing in 2007, 2008 was, you know, the Fed was, you know, pouring low interest money into the economy to try to keep the economy from crashing before the elections in November of 2008. They were not successful. As you recall, the economy crashed in the spring or summer of 2008, and all of a sudden, you know, all hell was breaking loose, and it did not help George W. Bush or John McCain in the general election. We got, you know, Barack Obama became president. This is the Financial Times article by Jamil Anderling in Beijing. He says, after China's stock market experienced its second worst day on Monday, all eyes are on Beijing, where the government faces a stark dilemma and a serious challenge to its credibility. Meanwhile, here in the United States, we just got the numbers for June home sales, new home sales. Remember, I said I'll get back to that in just a second. Sales, this is from MarketWatch. Sales of new single-family homes in the U.S. fell 6.8% in June, the slowest pace in 7 months. The median price of new homes, meanwhile, fell 1.8% compared to a year ago. And the supply of new homes increased. Back in May, there were, you know, it took on an average 4.8 months for a new home to sell. Now it's 5.4 months. So the housing market is slowing down. What are the other things that happened back in 2007 before the Great Crash? One of them was that commodities collapsed. A lot of people don't remember this, but the price of gold crashed, the price of oil crashed, the price of copper crashed. Commodities. And basically this was, you know, the commodities market looking at the fact that a crash was coming and saying, you know, when the crash happens, there's not going to be much demand for this stuff. So let's unwind our inflated prices right now. Interestingly enough, the Bloomberg Commodity Index just hit a 13-year low. It's lower than it was in 2007-2008. And I'd say that that's because we have been so aggressively pumping the economy for the last 6 years, 7 years, that, you know, we created another bubble. But this is, in my opinion, a major canary in the coal mine. Not only that, you know, money is pouring out of China right now. This is from Bloomberg. Robin Brooks at Goldman Sachs estimates that capital outflows topped $224 billion in the second quarter, a level beyond anything seen historically. When are we going to start calling it capital flight? So it just bad signs in general. Okay, that said, the Republicans are going to have their debate next week. Why are the Democrats not also having a debate so that Americans can see the difference between Republican ideas and Democratic ideas? Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, has said, you know, I'm not even going to schedule debates. We don't know when the first Democratic debate is, to the best of my knowledge. Now, that, you know, obviously she's doing this to help Hillary Clinton, but I think it's hurting Hillary Clinton, and I think it's hurting the Democrats. Because if we could have Democratic debates at roughly the same time Republican debates are happening, Americans would watch the Republican debates and hear these whack jobs, you know, fighting over who's going to cut, you know, who's going to, what was Jeb Bush's line, roll back Medicare or do away with Medicare altogether? Here they're going to be fighting about that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is the perfect contrast to Democrats talking about, you know, who's going to be more aggressive at strengthening Social Security. Come on, Debbie. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Lockport, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
How you doing today, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I wanted to talk a little bit about Bernie and the black community. You know, one of the things, I know we got a little flack for the Black Lives Matter issue, but one of the things I'd like to I'd like to see Bernie and all politicians actually on the Democratic side. I think I mentioned this with the Hispanic community, is that the onus is a little bit on them too. And the meaning, what I mean by that is that if they don't get out and vote, they can't make the changes that are necessary.
They being African Americans?
And the Latinos,
okay.
But the African American community, if they don't get out and vote, you know, one of the positive things that happened in Ferguson this year, or actually with that shooting, and let me tell you, this might be the only positive, is that the black community was energized.
Right.
They got out and voted, and they changed their town legislature slightly. And this is something that takes time, but it was a positive move.
Yeah. This
and
is,
and that goes with the you know the Latinos. They're talking about immigration reform. I still feel that they set immigration reform back maybe 5 to 10 years because they gave the Senate to the Republicans.
Right.
You've got, if you want to make change, the only way to make change is via the vote. We are all equal. And another thing, Tom, is I'd like to see us get away from the use of racial discrimination. I think that is a bad narrative. I think we should use the word ethnic discrimination. Why? Maybe if we get away from racial discrimination and use the word ethnic, maybe we'll realize we're all one on this planet.
Well, you know, it's nice to say that we're all one on this planet, but, you know, look at what's happening to black people across this country at the hands of police, at the hands of banksters, at the hands of real estate agents, at the hands of the business community. Look at what's happening at Native Americans. I mean, there's a Native American just was found dead in his jail cell, just like Sandra Bland. I'm going to rant about that a little bit. I think that as long as you've got the Klan protesting in South Carolina or anywhere else for that matter, that you've got to, you know, we need to be talking about race. I just, you know, I, you know, it would be very nice, Jim, I think, to be post-racial and, or ethnic. But ethnic, I mean, you know what? Italians and Greeks and Irish have the same problem that blacks do? No. African Americans are facing a, you know, you can't assimilate. If society is all about white power structures, then people who can't essentially pass as white, because there was a time in this country when Italians and when Irish specifically were not considered white people, and in the eyes of the Klan, Jews are not considered white people. It's really all about whiteness, I think, it's really all about race is what it comes down to. Am I making sense, Jim?
Yeah, Tom, you are. But like I said, I think if we got away from the narrative of race and ethnic discrimination, I think by changing the tone a little bit, maybe people will soften up to the idea that maybe we are all one. You know, Tom, it may take many, many years to do that, but it's possible.
It's going to take a couple generations. But, you know, and I think, Jim, we need to do structural stuff right away, which is the a variation in reparations, which means returning to the great society, like Lyndon Johnson started. Jim, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. Hillary Clinton has proposed a change that in tax law that would, in my opinion, be a really useful, positive first step toward minimizing or reducing the possibility of another great crash. There's something fundamentally, basically wrong with capitalism right now. As Edward Luce, I believe it is. Yeah, Edward Luce, writing in the Financial Times today. He says, last year, according to Goldman Sachs, Standard & Poor's 500 companies, the top 500 companies on the S&P index, spent more than $500 billion buying back their own stocks on share buybacks. He says, this year it's expected to hit $600 billion. Now, what is that? Well, when a company buys back its stock, it reduces the amount of stock that's out there, which increases the value of the stock. And if you've got a company that's worth $100 million and there's 100 million shares out there, then each share is worth $1. If you take 10 million shares off the marketplace, so now there's 90 million shares out there, each share becomes worth $1.10. You follow what I'm saying? So if you reduce the number of shares, you increase the price of the shares. Now, why do companies do this? Why are they spending this year $600 billion, half a trillion dollars buying back their own shares instead of giving better pay to their employees, instead of building new factories, instead of developing new products, instead of aggressively marketing what they have? Why? Why aren't they doing that? Why aren't they, you know, right now capital is almost free. The, you know, the lending rate is big companies can buy, can borrow money right now, you know, in the neighborhood of 1.5%. Why are they not borrowing money and building factories or just using their own profits? Why are they using their profits to the tune of $500 billion to buy back their shares? Well, there's a very simple reason that Hillary Clinton is suggesting addressing, and I salute her for this. Now, I know Bernie has a solution for this, too, and I like his solution, too, and I'll tell you what both of them are. But I just, you know, the fact that the principal Democratic candidates are talking about this stuff and could be discussing the differences in their approach, even though they're both good ideas, is a great idea. So anyhow, here's why these companies are buying back their stock. Prior to the 1980s, prior to the Reagan era, if you owned a company, or if you were the CEO of a company, or if you were a senior executive in a company, you got a paycheck. If you wanted to buy stock in the company, you could go out in the stock market and buy stock in the company. But you couldn't be paid in stock. You had to be paid in cash. Reagan changed those rules. Well, actually, Congress changed those rules, and they're IRS rules, but the Reaganomics, shall we say, changed those rules to say that the 1%, the 1/10th of 1%, the 1/100th of 1%, they can be paid in stock rather than with a paycheck. So you've got companies now that pay their CEOs $1 million a year, and then they give them $300 million worth of stock. Why would they do that? Well, here's the answer. Here's why. If that stock, say you're the CEO of, you know, a company X, some giant corporation, you get $1 million paycheck, but you've got, you know, $100 million in stock options, right, that's part of your compensation. If you can get the price of that stock to go up, say you can make that, you can increase the share value, the price of the stock by 10%. So your $100 million worth of stock becomes $110 million worth of stock. Actually, a little more than that, but for the purposes of rounding off, which means you make an extra $10 million when you sell it. So this is why the company buys back the stock, which jacks the price up, and then the executives sell the stock. It's what's called exercising your options. They sell the stock, and here's the juicy part of it. They don't pay the same income tax that you and I pay on our paychecks. If you're a surgeon and you're making $350,000 a year, you're paying 39.6% income tax. I mean, if you got a real job and you're making big money, and big $300,000 a year is not even big money anymore in America, weirdly enough, sadly enough. I mean, you got 20 guys on Wall Street last year who made $2 billion each. But if you make 300 grand or 400 grand as a physician, for example, you're paying 39% income tax. If you make 300 or 400 grand in selling your stock options, you pay what's called the capitalist gains tax or capital gains tax, which is maxed out right now at 25%. It was 20% up until a couple of years ago. So these guys get this tax break. It's like welfare for the CEOs. Maybe we should be drug testing them, right? So they get to take their money and they pay a lower income tax rate and you know, they're focused on this. So how do you stop this? Well, there's a couple ways to do it. One would be to simply reverse the Reagan era rules and say, sorry, you can't compensate executives with stock anymore. That's my personal preference. I wrote about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. Secondly, you'd have the essentially the same effect if you said that the capital gains income tax rate is exactly the same as the normal, as what's called ordinary income or earned income tax rate. In other words, banksters and CEOs pay the same taxes as surgeons. Well, now, you know, being compensated in stock doesn't make any sense. Why go through all that when you can just take a paycheck? Because you're going to pay the same tax rate. And that's basically, you know, Bernie has called for that. And that's basically what Hillary Clinton is saying. She's saying, well, give a discount, actually. The longer you own the stock, your capital gains rate will go down. Now, I disagree with that, at a policy level. But this is still a good first step. All right, so Hillary Clinton is saying, let's do this somewhat incrementally. But even that is considered revolutionary, what Hillary Clinton is proposing. Revolutionary in the business world, because it's like, you know, it's making CEOs' heads explode. This is the kind of stuff that we should be talking about. I mean, there should be Democratic debates right now so that when the Republicans are having their debates and they're bashing, you know, Medicare and Social Security and everything else, Democrats
can say something. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Once again, I think the DNC is being too clever by half, trying to protect Hillary, and instead they're going to hurt her and the party. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. In the second hour of our program, Robert Moffitt with the Heritage Foundation is going to drop by and tell us why, you know, we have to destroy Medicare now. And in the third hour of our program, Hillary Clinton has a new video out about climate change. And I'm really impressed by this. I think it's great. I'm going to play part of it on the air. And we will talk about this. Of course, all the other Democratic candidates, Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, Jim Webb. And, of course, Bernie Sanders. In fact, Bernie had a slap down with James Inhofe, Senator Inhofe, the climate denier extraordinaire from Oklahoma, in the Senate just a day or two ago, two or three ago. So they all, you know, everybody agrees this is a very, very big issue. So we'll see, you know, step by step. Anyhow, it's anything goes summer. So Rita in Chipley, Florida. Hey, Rita, thanks for watching. What's on your mind?
I'd like to ask you a question.
Okay.
Now, if you have more people working, you get more taxes collected.
Correct. Also, if those people are working at higher wages, like if you raise the minimum wage, you have higher tax collections. Yes.
But yet if the Republicans keep people from working, how can people pay their taxes?
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons why our economy, why our national debt is as high as it is, Rita, is that the Bush Great Depression or Great Recession or whatever you want to call it, the Bush crash, and it has led in part. I mean, you know, basically it's 35 years of Reaganomics, but what it has led to, household income right now is $2,000 lower than it was in 2007. So it's continued to decline. It's now around, it's gone from around 54,000 per household to around 52,000 is the either median or mean. I forget what it is. And what that means is that there's less tax collection. And less tax collection means you have a bigger deficit. And that, you know, so the Republicans sit around screaming about, oh, look at the deficit. The national debt has gone up under Barack Obama. Actually, the national debt, the debt has gone up. The deficit has actually gone down. Radically, it was running like almost $1 trillion a year when Obama came into office, and now it's down to about a quarter of a trillion, $250 billion a year. So it's, you know, quite substantially down. But much of this deficit is the consequence of the economy not growing, not being strong like it was, back pre-Reagan, shall we say? So yeah, you put your finger on a really important thing there, Rita. Thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Lisa in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Hey, before I make a comment about the stock market, what I called in for, is that with Medicare, please, you or your listeners, don't be deceived by the Republicans' options of getting a voucher. That's code for, if you have a 401k and or a pension, you won't qualify or yours will be reduced. And the reason why Medicare is so successful now is everybody gets it.
Right.
Once it becomes income, based and limited, it becomes another welfare program. You don't have the strong voting block of the senior citizens, and it gets cut and squeezed in the budget. So your grandchildren will think this is great. Oh, they're not going to take out for Medicare anymore. They're going to reduce my rate because they're going to tell us that it's going to go bankrupt and it's not going to be for us and all this other blah, blah, blah. And what a deal. And trust me, the voucher thing is code for turning it into welfare and then turning it into eliminating it. And I don't care how much money you have, you can never self-insure for medical coverage in your old age.
Very well said, Lisa.
I just wanted to make that point. The thing is about the stock market, and I realize that history isn't an accurate prediction of the future, but it is still a fact that under Democratic leadership in the White House, the stock market has always done better.
Right.
And I believe in 2016, the Republicans will win. And I will tell you why. When Hillary Clinton ran for the Senate after the White House, the media loved the stories about the first lady being a senator and how odd that was. They were following her around in Washington and in the hall. And Orrin B. Hatch and several other prominent Republicans came out, and they so praised her. They said she knew the facts. She knew the details. She didn't try to get the glory. The press would come to her and ask for a comment. She would defer to the leadership. She got voted in by just an unbelievable number of Republicans. The problem that happened is that they realized how popular and how competent she was, and she was going to be competition for them. So their plan is working, because I've heard prominent Democrats even say that they know that she's probably the best candidate for the White House, but they're kind of thinking they don't want to vote for her because they don't want to go through another 4 years of the Republicans having every type of made-up fake controversy like they did.
Well, they'll do that. They do that no matter who's in the White House. I mean, look at what they've done to Obama. He's a Kenyan. He's a Muslim. He's a terrorist. It's a terrorist fist jab. You know, his wife is too black, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just, which is essentially the argument that anyway.
That's why they're going to vote Republican. And I think the Republican Party is so smooth and slick in all of the states, you're going to have a really hard time getting a Democrat in. All you have to do is look at the midterm elections in Colorado, where they were able to mail in the applications. The senator out and out lied about his personhood response and in comments. And the editorial comes out and says that the Democrats are making this stuff up. Just
well,
put a criminal investigation against Hillary. That's a lie. I mean, they control everything now.
Yeah. Yeah, the New York Times has had to apologize twice now. They keep getting it wrong. There is no criminal investigation, and it's really quite remarkable. We'll see, Lisa. I mean, you know, as the great Zen master Mike Dirks says, yeah, we'll see. I'm not certain that Hillary can't beat any of these Republicans. I think there's a very good chance she could, and I think that Bernie could beat any of these Republicans. I have great doubts about Jim Webb. I don't think he's even a real Democrat. I mean, you know, deep down, all the way down to the bottom of his feet, I think he's not from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. I have Lincoln Chafee used to be a Republican, and Martin O'Malley seems like a decent guy, but he's got sort of Baltimore hanging around his neck, you know, as he was the mayor there and all these kind of things, so... I really think that the two leading candidates are Hillary and Bernie, and Hillary's way out ahead of Bernie, but Bernie has doubled his support in the last month, and he is the only candidate, and this is the interesting thing that just came out of this public policy poll that I was talking about last Friday, the only candidate whose positive perception outweighs the negative perception. The only person who has literally the only Republican or Democratic candidate for president of the United States right now who has a net positive favorability rating is Bernie Sanders. And I think that that's going to continue. I think it's going to increase. And you know, we'll see where this goes. The challenge that Bernie has is that the media doesn't want to have anything to do with him. They don't want to go near him. They don't like the message that he's delivering, which is stop the crazy trade deals, stop the big, you know, the big paychecks for the CEOs. And then, you know, the media, they want these trade deals because, you know, ABC is owned by Disney. And NBC owns Universal, and you know they make movies, and they want copyright protection all around the world, and so they want these trade deals, so they've got reciprocal enforcement and stuff like that. And so, you know, they're not going to talk about the issues that are actually affecting average Americans because they've got their own issues. But Lisa, it's well, we'll see. Thank you for sharing your contribution to our conversation. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Thought of several things since I've been on hold, but I called in to say, you know, that ever since Ronald Reagan, the Republicans have been trying to sell us, you know, this vision of just go back the way it used to be, you know, like in Happy Days, you know,
right.
Richie and Potsy and the bad boy, the baddest guy in town was the Fonz, and even he was a nice guy. And what they don't say is they actually want to go back to the 1890s where, you know, those 16 tons and your soul to company store.
Yeah, you're breaking up, Chris. But did you say that they don't want to go back to the 1950s? They want to go back to the 1890s, back to the Gilded Age?
Yeah, they're selling the 1950s, but what they really want is the 1890s.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Or at least the 1910s and 1920s when you had the Lochner Court. I absolutely agree, and some of them are coming right out and saying it. Yeah, totally. In fact, if we just went back to the 1950s, look at the 1956 Republican Party platform that Dwight Eisenhower ran for re-election on. It included the bragging about the fact that more than a million people had been added to the Social Security rolls, that Social Security had been substantially expanded, that union membership had grown by more than 2 million people in the previous year, or previous, maybe it was previous 4 years, I forget, but, you know, previous. They were bragging about the fact that they were increasing union membership, they were strengthening Social Security, they were building the social safety net, that they were fighting against racial discrimination. I mean, these were the things that the Republican candidate for president for re-election in 1956, Dwight Eisenhower, ran on. And there's no way that the Republicans want to run on that stuff. So no, and plus the top tax rate was 91%. No way the Republicans want to go back to that. So you're absolutely right, Chris. They don't want to go back to the 1950s. They want to go back to the 1890s when there were basically no taxes on rich people, at least no income taxes. And I mean, the income tax didn't even come along until 1913. And you know, they could just run the show. Chris, thanks for the call. Well said. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So here's a question. How do we get Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC to move up to start scheduling Democratic debates so we can contrast with the Republicans? Welcome back. Rick, watching Free Speech TV in Troy, New York. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've been trying to get through to you since around the New Year when you were talking about what were some of the big events of last year.
Holy cow.
I'm thinking the big event that people are most underestimating is the power of the people's right to petition through their right to vote.
Okay. Are you talking about how state after state is knocking people off the voting rolls? You know, Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas, has this voter list, 30, 40 million Americans, mostly registered as Democrats, who he says are fraudulently voting because they're registered in more than one state, or people of the same name are registered in more than one state, and so they keep getting knocked off the election rolls. This happened hugely in Colorado. I think it was over 300,000 people were taken off the election rolls, which I believe is why Cory Gardner got, you know, won. That and Mara Elias and NPR's support. She was actually misrepresenting his positions. I'm reluctant to use the word lie, but anyhow, is that what you're talking about, Rick?
No, I'm talking about the people's right to vote as also being the people's right to petition through the vote, like the initiative, referendum, and recall, whereby the people are the fourth branch. That's how California and Arizona and New Mexico have managed to create legitimate redistricting laws. That's how Move to Amend has enabled the people in some states to try to end Citizens United. That's how many states have decriminalized and legalized use of marijuana.
Yep.
There are many,
including the District of Columbia. Yeah.
Issues.
Here's the challenge, though, that kind of what you're talking about, Rick, is basically direct democracy. It's where the people themselves vote on laws. And, you know, I'm a big fan of direct democracy. I think it's a great thing, and only about half of our states allow it. That's the upside. The downside is that now that the Supreme Court has said you can throw virtually unlimited amounts of money, not even virtually, you can throw unlimited amounts of money into political issue advertising and even hide the source of it. Now we've got, you know, like the Mormon Church was flooding all this money into Prop 8 in California to stop the legalization of gay marriage in California, et cetera, et cetera. The GMO labeling failed in Oregon. You know, everybody wanted GMO labeling. It failed because Monsanto came in and dropped millions and millions of dollars into television advertising. Now that the Supreme Court has said to the big corporations and the billionaires, you can completely change public opinion. Even if the advertising is deceptive, even if it's outright lies, it's all protected by the First Amendment, and your right to run those ads are protected by the First Amendment. And I think as long as we've got this high level of corruption caused by large quantities of money in our electoral process, not only are our politicians vulnerable to being corrupted, and the entire Republican Party and a not inconsequential fraction of the Democratic Party have been, but also the ballot initiatives are corrupted by this process. Am I making sense, Rick?
Well, some states do not allow out-of-state money to interfere with intrastate matters.
I'm quite sure that the Supreme Court has ruled that a state can't do that. And I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Can you give me an example, Rick, real quick? Can you think of any state that has that law?
In GMO, Wisconsin, Texas have banned hydrofracking. This is going to go a lot further in the court than you might imagine.
Okay, we'll see how it plays out. Texas, interesting. Thanks, Rick. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Al in Beverly Shores, Indiana. Hey, Al, what's up?
Hey, I just want to get you talking about a new topic because, first of all, I want to say that I really admire your research and the work you're doing. I secondly want to say that you have yet to say something I disagree with.
But
two characteristics that all of these mass shooters have had in common. Yeah. One of them is they've had guns. Everybody's talking about that. But the second and most important thing is they've all had psychiatric disorders. Most of them have been pre-diagnosed psychiatric disorders.
Al, who's going to shoot up a theater except somebody who's a little crazy? You know, the day that kid murdered those 20 children in Newtown, Connecticut, that same day, there was a mass killer in China, in Beijing, China, and he went into a school and he attacked over 30 children. And the difference is that in that attack in China, the guy had a knife. 30 children were injured and taken to the hospital. Nobody died. Adam Lanza had an AR-15. 20 children were blown, and some of them, their bodies were so badly mutilated by these giant bullets, you know, from this weapon of war, that they had the difficulty identifying the children, who they were. I mean, they'd been that badly shot up, not to mention the teachers. So, we've got mental health issues, but that's not what's causing these shootings. What's causing these shootings is easy availability of guns.
Yeah, but if you treat the mental health issues, if you do secondary...
Hal, you're always going to have crazy people. We have 320 million people in this country.
That's the idea. You want to attack, deal with the issues that are driving these people.
But you can't, you know, it's a hell of a lot easier to do like Australia did after that mass shooting in Tanzania in 1998. Which was the 17th or 18th mass shooting that Australia had in the previous couple of decades. And they just said, okay, that's it. It's over. And they did a nationwide nationwide gun buyback, and they put very, very serious constraints on who could own a gun. You had to demonstrate a need for it. You had to be licensed, and you had, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, the reasonable gun control. If sportsmen could still have guns, and women, sports, and people who need them for security could still have guns, but and there has not been a single mass shooting in Australia. I guarantee you the number of crazy people in Australia and it probably that's almost a slur phrase, but I don't know how else to say it, mentally ill people, let's say, has not gone down. What has gone down is the availability of guns. So they haven't had a mass shooting since 1998 in Australia when they did this. It's a hell of a lot easier to get the guns off the street than it is to go from person to person who visits a psychiatrist and say, is this person potentially a mass shooter? And then on what basis are you going to lock them up for how long so that they don't do the mass shooting? I mean, there's just no way to anticipate. But if you can keep the guns out of their hands, then I think that you've got a good first step. So, Al, I respectfully disagree with you. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about other models of corporations, like, you know, employee-owned corporations,
right,
as a possible way of just changing, you know, how corporations are run to make them more responsible to both the employees and, you know, and the general public. And a good example of that is F. Scott Bader Limited, which was started by a Quaker. And, you know, this corporation, you know, its preamble or its constitution starts out saying that I want to make, you know, this corporation not able to be corrupted by, you know, being sucked into using their products for war and things of this sort. And, you know, it's been very, very successful. And the one of the descendants recently won the Gandhian Award. You know, the employees do a great job of running the corporation. And, you know, it's also more effective because, I mean, in the corporation that I work for, it's a non-profit hospital corporation, out of 7,000 employees, only 2,000 people actually do direct patient care. There's this whole huge structure that, you know, really doesn't do any productive work, in my opinion.
Well,
and so,
and a lot of that's dealing with insurance companies, though.
Well, you know, a lot of it is just administrative jobs that have been created.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's dealing with insurance companies. Some of it is support staff. But there are a lot of, I would say, non-productive jobs or jobs that, you know, where you have a manager and an assistant manager and then another manager, and none of these people do any of the patient care. I mean, that's what we're all about. And yet they will tell us, you know, oh, we're being cut, you know, for this. We can't
right.
hire a person for this.
So you think an employee-owned company would behave differently than a nonprofit?
I think an employee-owned company would behave a lot differently, and I think that the employees in the employee-owned company would be a lot happier. We would have direct control because it's a power thing. I mean, you're much happier. I mean, you're self-employed, aren't you? I mean, yeah. And
well, sort of. I mean, we have a corporation that I run a paycheck through, but yeah.
Right. So. I think generally speaking, when people own their own means of production, I mean, that's essentially what happens there, then, you know, they have more control, they have more satisfaction because things aren't meaningless. There's so much paperwork and things that I do in my job that are just dictated to me that make no sense, and I have no control over that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are in the same position. I know another person who works for a university, and the grants that they get, about half of the money goes to management costs
right. Instead
of into the research. I mean, isn't this the biggest scam, you know, ever? And I think
And increasingly, if I may, because we're just about out of time, increasingly what we're seeing is that the distinction between nonprofits and for-profits is being blurred. And the way that they're taking money out of the nonprofits is just through obscenely high salaries. You know, people making $1 million or multiple millions of dollars a year running not-for-profit organizations. It's crazy. And I'm with you. This is why the last chapter of my book, Threshold, was all about Mondragon. The reason I went to Spain and visited Mondragon. And then I also went to Madison, Wisconsin, and visited Peninsula Manufacturing and Union Cab, employee-owned companies. And I agree with you, John. I absolutely agree with you. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert Moffitt is on the line. Dr. Robert Moffitt, Ph.D., Director of the Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, the website. Dr. Moffitt, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. I hope you are well, too.
I am fine, Tom. Just got back from San Diego and 3 weeks of surfing. So.
Oh, that sounds nice. That sounds really nice.
Okay, yeah, here I am in Washington.
So our question, why do Republicans want to destroy Medicare? Why is it that Jeb Bush is saying we need to kill off this program?
You know, Tom, why do the Republicans beat their wives? Why do the Republicans want to destroy the environment? Why
I don't think Jeb Bush ever said he wants to beat his wife.
Tom, let's stop. Stop it, Tom. Fact of the matter is nobody's talking about destroying Medicare. The president of the United States has said routinely that millions of Americans rely on Medicare. At the same time, the president said, look, we're spending too much to sustain the program. We must reform the system. We have to protect the current seniors. And if we don't, it won't be there in the future when future seniors need it. So we have to reform the Medicare program. Now, the president is absolutely correct. The question is, how do we do that?
Was not the woman who said to Jeb Bush when he said that he explicitly did say, you probably know the word, phase out. Yeah, he said we need to phase out Medicare and replace it with something where people can have some equity, essentially, which sounds to me like health savings accounts. This woman said, I have paid into Medicare my whole life.
Right.
I mean, a 30-year-old right now who has been working since they were 18 has paid into Medicare for 12 years.
Right.
You're saying to them, A, your Medicare is not going to be here, and by the way, thanks a lot for the money?
No. The fact is what the issue here is, the woman actually said, I saw the clip, the woman said, this is not an entitlement, which, of course, is nonsense. Medicare is an entitlement. Everybody who is paid into Social Security and anybody who's on the railroad retirement program is eligible by virtue of an entitlement to Medicare services. What Bush is saying to her, in effect, and what every economist I know, including people in the administration, will tell the woman, is that, in fact, she did pay into Medicare. But Medicare is a pay-as-you-go program, which means those who pay into it during their working lives, those people who pay into it now are paying for the senior benefits that are being delivered today. So it's a pay-as-you-go system. The problem is with this woman and a number of other people, and the Republicans and Democrats alike, is that they think they paid for their benefits. But in the same article, PolitiFact pointed out that, in fact, people actually get back two or three times or more what they actually did pay in to Medicare. So, in fact, people today who are on retirement or in Medicare are not actually paying for their benefits.
But if
that money has already been spent.
If you had been paying throughout your entire working life into a stock fund, you would get back three or four times
what
you put
correct.
In, number one.
But it's not
and number two, how is that different from insurance?
Well, it is different from insurance in this sense. I mean, the Medicare is not, strictly speaking, an insurance program.
It is. It's a single-payer insurance program.
It is a social insurance program. But it's a social insurance program, which is based on a pay-as-you-go basis. There is no trust fund in which there is savings assets.
There doesn't need to be one.
Pardon?
There doesn't need to be one.
Well, no, I guess it doesn't. But then it's also wrong to say that you're paying for your benefits when, in fact, the money that you paid into to Medicare during your working life is already gone. It's already spent.
That's a distinction without a difference.
No,
the system wouldn't exist if you weren't paying into it throughout your working life.
Tom, listen to me. It's a very big point because a lot of people misunderstand how Medicare is actually financed. Medicare is very popular, but a lot of people don't understand how it actually operates and how it actually runs. The truth of the matter is, as our friends at the Urban Institute, certainly no ideological bedfellows of the Heritage Foundation, have pointed out, people who have paid into Medicare during their working lives actually pay very little comparison to what they get out. What has happened with
depends on what their income is.
Pardon?
It depends on what their income is.
It depends on what their income is, but you're talking, as they say, roughly between two and three times, actually.
If you're making $20,000 or $30,000 a year throughout your working life, yes. If you're making $118,000 a year throughout your working life, no, you're probably going to get back less than you paid in.
No, that all depends, because Medicare, the problem with Medicare is not like Social Security in that respect. Everything depends upon your health care costs. You could, for example, be paying at $130,000, you could have that kind of an income and so on. But then at the end of the day, you know, if you come down with something like colon cancer, you might cost the federal government as much as $1 million. So the payments that you make in Medicare during your working life are not really connected in any direct way to the cost.
Right. They shouldn't be. That's how insurance works, Robert.
The cost can vary dramatically.
But that's how insurance works. If I pay, $100 a month into a life insurance policy, for 50 years and then die versus 5 years and then die, and it's $1 million policy, my wife is going to get $1 million. And if I die in 5 years, I mean, you're basically betting with the insurance company and hoping that you lose the bet. Right. I don't see the difference.
Medicare is not, strictly speaking, an insurance program. It is basically an entitlement which is based on taxation. And the reason why Jeb Bush, made the argument that he made, or made the point that he made, is that it's not fiscally sound, is precisely the reason why the Medicare trustees, who have just issued their report last week, and just the same way that President Obama has said, is that unless we reform the program, it's not going to be there.
So what's your proposed reform, Robert?
What's my proposal?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that the best remedy is to expand what, in fact, is working very well in Medicare. We have a Medicare prescription drug program that is doing quite well.
For the drug companies?
Well,
in other words, you don't want the government to be able to negotiate drug prices?
It's doing very well for senior citizens. If you look at the facts on the ground, both the drug program and the health insurance program have provided a very, very wide variety of benefits for people at stable prices.
But the drug that drug program, Robert, is a $630 billion over a decade gift to the pharmaceutical industry, because it forbids the federal government. And this is so weird from negotiating prices. I mean, the Veterans Administration can say, okay, this year we're going to use 1 million aspirin, so we'd like them for a penny a piece rather than a dollar a piece.
Right.
And the pharmaceutical companies say, okay, fine, we'll negotiate that price. But Medicare can't do that.
No, Medicare does not fix prices in Medicare Part D.
No, the drug companies do.
No, is a product of negotiation between private health plans and the drug companies, just like it is in private insurance, just like it is.
But it is not negotiated between the government, and the government is a larger purchaser of these things than probably any of the individual insurance companies, unless there's another merger and acquisition coming along.
You use the Veterans Administration program as a model, and I understand that. But the point is that, as our friends at the Congressional Budget Office have pointed out, if you want to use the VA as a model, it also means that you have to have a restriction on the drugs that are available to the senior citizen.
There's already that restriction.
Well, actually, no. If you look at Medicare Part D, the Medicare drug program, it's got a huge variety of drugs that are available at competitive prices, and that's just a fact.
They're not competitive prices. The federal government cannot negotiate with the drug companies for discounts. That's corporate welfare. I'm astonished that a conservative would be in favor of welfare.
Very good, Tom. But the point is that they don't have to negotiate with the drug companies, because the private health care plans in the private market, they do the negotiation for us.
Okay. Robert Moffitt, I give you the last word. Heritage.org is the website. Thank you for dropping by.
Okay.
Good talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls on Anything Goes Summer right after this. Welcome back. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Tom, I was just thinking of a constitutional amendment that'll solve about 80% of what's wrong with America today.
Okay.
And this is it. for every dollar that you spend on national defense, you have to spend an equal dollar on social welfare programs.
Hmm.
And I just think that the...
I think we're actually spending more on social... I think we're spending more on social welfare programs right now than we are on national defense. I may be wrong, but I think that...
$300 billion or $700 billion on national defense?
I know, and I think we're spending over $2 trillion on Social Security, Medicare, unemployment. You add all that stuff up, it's I know it's well over a trillion.
Social Security is not part of the budget.
I understand.
That doesn't count.
Okay.
So what counts is like food stamps and low-income housing. That's social welfare programs.
And Medicare is part of the budget, is it not?
Medicare.
I'm pretty sure.
We're just talking about that. Don't people pay into Medicare and then
they do. There's a tax for it. There's a specific tax for it. But the point is that
so it's not part of the budget then.
No, I don't think it's segregated the way the Social Security is. I think that the tax goes into the general pot and the payments go out of the general pot. I mean, I might be wrong on this, but I don't think I am. We should get a Medicare expert on to talk about this. But I don't dislike your idea, Ed. But why not just say we're spending too much money on war and not enough money on our own people?
Think what would happen the next time that some congressman wants to spend $40 billion for a new fleet of nuclear submarines if he realizes that he also has to spend $40 billion for food stamps.
Right. Or for low-income housing.
Yeah, blood in the aisles.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting idea. It's a very interesting idea. Let me chew that over for a while and ponder it. Thank you, Ed. You gave me something to think about here. Thank you. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
I have a better idea. How about we double social spending for every dollar of military spending? I don't like them even matched. That's not good enough. Too much energy goes towards the military. We've got too many bases around the world. Need to shut her down.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
That redneck comedian whose name escapes me right now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you.
Anyway, why I called, by the way, I didn't care too much for the semi-quasi-condescending attitude from your guest from the Heritage Foundation. When they do like that, that really irritates me and turns me off.
Yeah. Well, he's not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to comment. Thank you for that.
That's why I called.
But you wanted to talk about the DNC scheduling debates.
The DNC purposefully does not schedule their debates. And this is not just isolated to this election. This goes back to as far as I can remember as a kid. Why I never got to see these debates back to back from both parties.
No, in 2008 they were doing it.
The
Democratic debates were happening roughly the same time the Republican debates were, and I think that the contrast is one of the things that helped get Barack Obama elected.
Well, you said the word right there, contrast. That's where I'm heading to. I think this all feeds into the idea that third parties, like the Greens Party, have a purposefully hard time. They're put on the back burner by rules and regulations set forth behind closed doors by the leadership of both the Democrats and the Republicans. And I think this helps towards that, because if Democrats were really adversarial, as they should be, towards the Republicans, like the press, it should be towards both.
Yeah, Jonathan, I think you're mixing apples and oranges here, but I do understand your point and don't disagree with it. Thank you. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So where do we go with Medicare? Medicare is, in my book Rebooting the American Dream, there's a whole chapter dedicated to let's make Medicare a nationwide single payer program. Now, there's two ways that we could go about doing this that are fairly straightforward and easy. The first would be to include Medicare as one of the options that you can choose when you buy your health insurance via Obamacare, basically through the Affordable Care Act. That's called the public option. And if it wasn't for Joe Lieberman, we would have the public option as part of Obamacare, and it would be driving down the price of health insurance. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's been two proposed very large mergers. One of them was just approved by the federal government between health insurance companies. So the middle-sized health insurance companies are merging to become giants. We're going to end up, just like we have only four major airlines in the United States, we're going to end up with four major insurance companies. And that's not competition. That's it's not monopoly because it's not mono, it's not one company, but they behave as if they're one company. They fix prices. They call it setting prices. And these companies, these health insurance companies, are mind-bogglingly profitable. Their stock values have been going up steadily since the introduction of Obamacare. So if they had some competition from Medicare, you would see, A, you would see their profit dropping somewhat, and B, you would see their prices going down. And there, yeah, there's a relationship between those two. So that's one way to do it, is make it a public, you know, write a public option into Obamacare. Now, that's not going to happen when Republicans control the House and Senate, but if we can get Democratic control of the House and Senate in the election of 2016, that could happen, and it would be a great, that would be a great step number one. Step number two is even more radical than that. It's specifically what I recommended in my book, The Rebooting the American Dream, and that, you know, Bernie sent this book out to all 99 other senators along with a cover letter saying, you need to read this. He read part of it on, you know, when he did his eight-hour filibuster on the floor, you know, read from one of my chapters, one of the chapters in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. And that specific proposal was that every year Medicare drop its eligibility rate by one decade. Because it's going to take a year or so for the Medicare bureaucracy, and I say that in the positive sense of the word, to expand enough to handle the new claims, right? So next year, the eligibility age for Medicare goes from 65 down to 55. The year after that, the eligibility age goes from 55 to 45. The year after that, the eligibility age goes from 45 to 35. And so on until finally the eligibility age is zero. It's birth. And you can get into Medicare, number one. And number two, let's strengthen Medicare by taking all the private for-profit stuff that has been inserted into it by Republicans since it was first put into law by Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s as part of the Great Society programs. Let's take that stuff out. It's crazy that United Healthcare is the largest provider of Medicare Part, whatever it is. You know, the so-called supplemental plans. Republicans, they drill holes in Medicare, and then they say, oh, my God, there's a hole in Medicare. Well, hey, it's an opportunity for Stephen J. Hemsley to make another $1 billion. And it's just, it's, in my opinion, it's wrong. It should not be. We should have a national single-payer health care system, just like every other developed country in the world has or has some variation on, that everybody in the country is covered. It is a right, not a privilege. It's in our Declaration of Independence that we should, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, how can you have the right to life and not heal people when they're sick? It makes no sense. So, in my humble opinion, if we get the corporations out of Medicare, number one, do away with this whole, you know, Medicare Part B thing, where you have to go to a private for-profit insurance company and give them a couple hundred bucks every month. Blow that out. Do away with that. We don't need it. It's just producing billions, literally billions of dollars in profits for the big health insurance companies. Take it out. And then secondly, Medicare Part D, which says explicitly, and this is why Billy Towson got a job. He was the floor manager for this legislation in the House of Representatives, the former congressman from Louisiana. We had him on this program, in fact. And he kind of did a mea culpa, I suppose you could call it. But, you know, he pushed this thing through, and then pharma, the drug lobby, offered him a $2 million a year job as the head of pharma. So he goes from $160,000 a year, $130,000, I think it was back then, $130,000 a year annual salary as a congressman to a $2 million a year annual salary as the head of the lobbying group, Pharma. And he wanted to leave Congress so fast to get that money that I don't remember who it was a Denny Hastert or whoever was the Speaker of the House at the time, Tom DeLay, whatever the Republican was, who was running the House of Representatives at that time. This is back in 2006, as I recall. Actually got Billy Towson's special permission to leave the House of Representatives before his term was over so he could start making his money as payback for pushing through this piece of legislation that says that, you know, when Medicare pays for your drugs, they have to pay the full price, which is nuts. Medicare's got to be buying millions, particularly, you know, since Medicare is for seniors, for things like, you know, blood pressure medication, you know, the Lipitor things, what do you call them, things that reduce cholesterol, the statin drugs and things like that. They've got to be buying millions of these things. But they're paying as if they were buying individual prescriptions. Full retail. It's a $600 billion gift to the big pharmaceutical industry. And now those companies are using that money to pour money into the campaigns of largely Republican members of Congress to get them to put Republicans plus maybe 30 Democrats to get them to push through things like the TPP that would force high-priced drugs on other countries as well. And most of these drug companies aren't even American companies anymore. They're based in Switzerland or Germany.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It is really and truly and genuinely mind-boggling how these big corporations have used the Republican Party to screw you and me. It's amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, all kinds of interesting stuff over at Democratic Underground. They put a graphic up. Rick Perry. The problem of movie theater gun massacres can be solved by encouraging moviegoers to jump out of their seats and start shooting at each other in the dark. Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. The stupidity of Republicans. Jake Tapper says, you seem to be suggesting that a solution to the problem would be to allow patrons in the movie theater to bring guns with them into the movie theater. Rick Perry, I think that makes a lot of sense. Borowitz's funny piece today is about how the bar has been lowered. He comments, it's over at the New Yorker, he comments about how he's quoting the fictitious Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota, and he says, you know, we thought that the bar had been lowered pretty badly in 2008 with the Republican vice presidential nominee. That would be Sarah Palin. But now it's all the way to the floor. Yeah. You think so? Okay, this is the latest national poll. This is really interesting. Sanders 48, Bush 47. Sanders 48, Walker 42. Sanders 59, Trump 38. Bernie Sanders beats all the leading candidates in the Republican field. Zed Jelani has this piece over at Alternet right now. This is a brand new CNN poll just released. It shows that Bernie Sanders is beating all of the Republican major candidates. If you limit the poll sample to just registered voters, Bush beats Sanders by 1 point. Zed Jelani says, either way, this credible poll shows that Sanders is not just some pie-in-the-sky general election candidate. His more uphill battle may be the primary. But even there, he has some strengths. Polling out last week shows he's the only candidate from either side who has a net favorability rating. And Donald Trump, you know, I had this conspiracy theory that Donald Trump was representing the interests of the billionaires to try and take down Jeb Bush and bring in Scott Walker. I still believe this to be the case. We published this. I wrote this up early last week, and it finally got published on Saturday on alternate.org. And maybe, it was Saturday. And within a few hours of it being published, Donald Trump decided that he was going to trash Scott Walker, which I had pointed out. He had never said anything about Scott Walker. But he didn't actually trash Scott Walker. He didn't call him a loser. He didn't call him any names at all. He talked about how how Wisconsin was having problems. They have a big budget deficit. They're billions of dollars in debt, blah, 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 blah. But he didn't say Scott Walker's a loser, like he said about Jeb Bush. He didn't say Scott Walker couldn't negotiate with anybody, like he said about Jeb Bush. He didn't say Scott Walker is essentially a fool, like he has implied about Jeb Bush. He didn't say Scott Walker's only there because of his family connections, which he's implied about Jeb Bush. I don't think that, and, you know, people are responding. You can read it over at Alternet, and it's been picked up by a few other places at alternate.org. I still stand by this as my favorite, my pet conspiracy theory for the season. And we will see. We will see. But I think that when it's clear that Scott Walker is the nominee, Donald Trump will vanish. I could be wrong. It's going to be real interesting to see. Anyhow, anything goes summer. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, I don't like calling this the crash. I like calling it the systematic withdrawal from the middle class and poor.
Oh, well, that's been going on for 35 years.
The tool they use to do that is called mutual funds. See, a small investor, he doesn't get to choose individual stocks
right.
to invest in because he doesn't have the amount of money that would profit him.
Right.
So he invests in mutual funds. And within those mutual funds, he doesn't have the choice of individual stocks. So the powers that be can crash a number of stocks in his mutual funds to extract the money that he has in there. And it'll take him years to recover just back to the point where he lost.
Sure. And anybody who was a big stock owner in 2006 knows what you're talking about.
In the mid-50s, late 50s,
yeah.
early 60s, they offered these mutual funds to people who want to get in the market.
Yep.
And then they use those mutual funds as tools to extract the money from the poor and the middle class.
Well, the way that that transition happened, Corky, was when Reagan came along and said, we're going to do away with defined benefit programs, what we call pension plans, and we're going to replace them with defined income programs or defined whatever they're called. Defined contribution plans, that's what they're called, which is a 401k or an IRA, and where basically you are setting money aside and sticking it in the stock market. And we're going to do this so that people feel like they have skin in the game. We want to make the average working person think the same way that a billionaire thinks in terms of, oh, the stock market's a wonderful thing, and we need to do everything we can to help the so-called job creators who gamble their money in the stock market. But, you know, I'm with you. This was brought to you courtesy of Ronald Reagan. Corky, thank you for the call. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. Well, I was going to bring up that Trump kind of trashed Walker. I still kind of see what you're saying there. So I'm gonna.
It didn't even make the news.
You and your conspiracy.
You know, I mean, it didn't make the news. When Trump said that Jeb Bush was weak, that made the news, and I think it hurt Jeb Bush.
Right.
He didn't go after Scott Walker personally. He went after.
No, you're right.
Basically, Republican policies personal. In Wisconsin.
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't personal. He did say that he kind of screwed up the neighboring states and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But he didn't say anything. He didn't take any, personal swipe at them. So
right.
I'm going to hang in there with your theory.
Okay.
I also wanted to mention that Bernie Sanders was the first guest on Meet the Press yesterday, and he would not let Chuck Todd put words in his mouth. He was as feisty can be. I love him. My wife and I have donated a few hundred dollars now to his campaign, and we do so on a monthly basis.
Wow.
And I wanted to also remind everybody that on Wednesday is his national event where there's all different kinds of places all over the country. You just go to BernieSanders.com and go to events. It'll say find an event in your area. Click on that, type in your zip code, and it'll tell you. I think you mentioned it last week. It'll tell you, where I live, it's a little bit rural, but there's at least 10, 15 places, some in people's homes.
Yeah.
I'm going to the one at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And
yeah, there's a dozen or so of them within a mile or two of where Louise and I live, and about half of them are totally full right now. So if you want to show up at one of these things Wednesday night, you need to get over to BernieSanders.com right now.
Yep, make sure you RSVP so they know you're coming. They can prepare.
Yeah, you got to do that.
It's going to be awesome.
Yep. And I was in the air. Louise and I went to Michigan for a family reunion. We flew out Saturday morning. We flew back Sunday morning. So I missed Meet the Press. But I have seen, actually, we were in bed last night watching the clip of Bernie on Meet the Press on Louise's laptop. And Chuck Todd kept wanting to talk about Donald Trump, and Bernie kept saying, I don't know about Donald Trump, but let me tell you, we got it. The billionaires taking out America. I thought he was brilliant. Bernie has so figured out how to hand these guys their rear ends. It's just, it was brilliant. I agree with you, John. I absolutely do. And then Shano and Danielle were telling me how after that there was apparently a panel conversation and they were actually speaking well of Bernie. That's an impressive next step. That's a very impressive next step. John, thank you for the call. Bruce in Long Valley, New Jersey. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hi, Tom. No, I want to bring up about Medicare with that discussion you had with the other gentleman before.
Yeah, with Robert Moffitt from the Heritage Foundation, yeah.
Right. I just obtained Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
I have to pay like almost $300 a month. So right. It's not that the other the current workers are funding the retired workers, and the retired workers have to fund a big part of this themselves.
You're right. I wish I had remembered that. I'm not yet Medicare eligible, so I'm not as well educated about it as I should be.
Think about you.
Yeah.
But another thing is the minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, they've been holding this down for 20 years, and that's another form of funding the Medicare for long term.
Right.
And, right. You know, if a person's making $30,000, put X amount in, and somebody made $200,000, put a lot more in, they're the same age, at age 70. They both have to have a bypass operation, the same type and everything. Well, the government has to put more money. The $30,000 person didn't put in enough money.
Right. Which is why we need to raise the minimum wage. You raise the minimum wage nationwide to $15 an hour, and if we did this quickly enough, it would solve a lot of our economic problems, particularly it would probably make Social Security and Medicare completely solvent forever. Or at least it would be a big step in that direction, because as you correctly point out, Bruce, it's those people on the bottom of the wage scale. You know, literally every penny of your income is taxable for Social Security and Medicare, the payroll tax, whereas a lot of people, as Mitt Romney pointed out, 47% of people make so little that they don't have to pay federal income taxes. And so, you know, they're not paying, you know, but they're still paying into Medicare and Social Security. You're right.
Right.
So if we raise their wages, they'll be paying more into Medicare and Social Security because it's a percentage of their income. And thank you for reminding me about the fact that you actually have to pay for Medicare. I totally spaced that. Bruce, thank you. I tell you, we got the smartest listeners on Earth. Thank you for listening to SiriusXM, and thanks for calling in, Bruce. Great to hear from you. We will be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is great. We got a tweet from Patrick Egan. He says, tell your guests that Medicare is an earned benefit. An entitlement is Jeb Bush thinking that we owe him the presidency. And welcome back. Liz in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Liz. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Near the end of the first hour, you had a caller who pointed out that there were only very few, maybe two things in common with mass shooters, and he missed one completely. I have never heard of a female mass shooter.
Right. Ever. And with the exception of that one guy in Washington, D.C. about 6 years ago or so, I don't know of any black mass shooters.
Right, and those were actual snipers, that man and
yeah.
The boy he had. They weren't. It wasn't even like a single event.
Yeah, John Malvo or whatever his name was, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. And it occurred to me also that, you know, this is almost like a sign of the end of patriarchy, just like now that we're exposing so much of how racism works in America, there's a great backlash. It's the same when you end patriarchy. It's like this whole thing about rape culture and objectification.
Right.
At the same time, on the other side, who are the ones who are reacting explosively and violently? It's the men. And in this case, white men. It's like a double whammy on white men.
That's a really interesting observation. Do you think that the rise of white male shooters, mass shooters, is tied to the rise, you know, as a reactive response to the rise of the empowerment of women and people of color in this country?
Oh, absolutely. They used to be able to use by just simple law intimidation and impunity under the law what they cannot now. You know, they
right.
used to be able to, you know, women couldn't have their own financial freedom until the early 70s, reproductive freedom starting in the 60s
right.
and 70s. And same with African Americans with the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. And that's when a lot of the backlash got even worse. I mean, there was always violence, both economic and physical sorts, towards women and towards minorities. But it was kind of part of the system. Everyone knew about it. No one fought it. It wasn't overt and in your face, and you didn't have, you know, the same kind of media either. I mean, we all just see it instantaneously. And,
right.
But, you know, for all the sensationalism that newspapers may have had about some events, they were more celebrated. And now, we abhor them for the most part, or we're completely divided. You know, we have people of our political persuasion being horrified by these events and saying that there is something in common, while, again, the ones who don't want to even think about it are, you know, who are entrenched in their old style beliefs, don't see a connection.
And this last mass shooter he had a Tea Party profile. He was a fan of the Confederate flag, and he had talked about how women were basically getting too uppity, and the two people that he murdered successfully immediately were women.
Sure.
So this is the misogynistic backlash, or the it's kind of in the zeitgeist. It's in the spirit of the times.
And it's no wonder they feel so victimized and under siege.
Yeah, and the Republicans, of course, are trying to roll back women's reproductive rights. You know, access to birth control, access to abortion. And they're trying to roll back the rights of people of color by rolling back the Civil Rights Act. You know, the Supreme Court took an axe to it. And then with these voter suppression ID laws all across the country, specifically designed to disenfranchise people of color. Liz, there's a lot to unpack there, but I think that's a brilliant observation. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV, and thank you for calling and making it. It's great to hear from you. Thank you. We'll be back. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. It's brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org, and Victoria Jones on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
At a press conference today in Ethiopia, President Obama let loose and scolded Republicans Mike Huckabee, Donald Trump, and Ted Cruz for a series of campaign trail attacks, not all against him, that he said would be ridiculous if it weren't so sad.
Yeah, it seems like what Donald Trump has done is basically lowered the bar, or raised the bar, I guess, for what you have to do to get national coverage so that you can be in the Republican debates and be considered a Republican frontrunner. You have to be outrageous. And so here you got Huckabee talking about, you know, it's the Jews off to the ovens if Obama gets his way. And you've got Ted Cruz going off about, you know, Mitch McConnell lied to me, and lots of other weird things. Rick Perry talking about, you know, the way to solve mass shootings in theaters is for everybody in the theater to have a gun and start firing in the dark. Pardon
yes,
me. Yeah.
Exactly. President Obama took quite a stern tone about this. He singled out Cruz for suggesting in the wake of the nuclear deal that Obama is the leading state sponsor of terrorism, not Iran, which indeed he did. And he also said, we've had a sitting senator called John Kerry Pontius Pilate. We've had a sitting senator who also happens to be running for president suggest that I'm the leading state sponsor of terrorism. These are leaders in the Republican Party, he said, totally incredulously. Then he also went after Trump for attacking John McCain for his heroism. Then he said, when outrageous comments and statements are made about me, a lot of people outraged about McCain were pretty quiet. And he said it grew out of a culture where those types of comments are tolerated.
I think he's absolutely right.
So it was pretty stern stuff and really very interesting.
Yeah.
So, of course, Huckabee doubled down on what he said.
Well, they all will, because by doubling down, they get another bite into the apple of the news cycle.
There you go. Then, other news, the United States has spent more than $3 billion on the military campaign against ISIS. Whoa. Pentagon said in an update today, $3.21 billion as of July the 15th, so more than that by now. Since the campaign against ISIS began on August the 6th, military operations have cost an average of $9.4 million a day.
Wow.
Wow. Bulk of the money, 53%, has been spent on airstrikes. So about a quarter of the money has been spent on weapons.
And none of that money has been spent on struggling Americans.
No, because it's been spent on ISIS.
Right.
Meanwhile, over in the Senate, I'm sure you're aware of the extraordinary play that's been going on with Ted Cruz accusing Mitch McConnell of flat-out lying.
Right.
On Friday.
Yeah, is it true that this has never happened before, that no senator has ever accused the majority leader of being a liar?
Well, apparently such a breach of decorum? Rick Santorum did some time ago in 1995. Robert Byrd took to the floor and issued an extraordinary speech. He said, I've never heard that word used in the Senate before in addressing other senators. I've never heard other senators called liars. I've never heard a senator say that other senators lie. The use of such maledicent language on the Senate floor is quite out of place.
And who was other senators? Who was Santorum calling out when he said that?
It doesn't say who he was calling out, but Byrd makes the point that Clay and John Randolph fought a duel over less than that. Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton for less than that.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, of course, that was a different era. I mean, you know, it's
different era.
But it would be interesting to see a duel between Mitch McConnell and Ted Cruz.
That would be fascinating.
Indeed. I mean, you know, Ted Cruz is a big gun supporter.
He is. But you've got to ask, who would be Ted Cruz's second?
Probably Rand Paul. No. It would be Mike Lee, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well, he's the only one.
Yeah. Yeah, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee are the three amigos.
That's indeed.
As the third one is, you know, brainless, but anyway, because there is no third one.
Crossing over the pond, senior peer of the House of Lords, Lord Sewell, has been granted a leave of absence from the House of Lords after being filmed allegedly taking drugs with prostitutes. Well, there was not much allegedly about it, really.
Yeah.
He said he wouldn't attend the Lords until the outcome of any investigation into his conduct, after which he'd review his long-term position. The expose, which was in the Sun tabloid yesterday, shows him snorting three lines of cocaine in 45 minutes, putting on a prostitute's orange bra, prancing around his apartment, then romping around nude and sniffing cocaine from one of the prostitute's breasts.
Wow. He needs to do an Anthony Weiner and just say, okay, that's it, I'm out of here.
Well, he does. He also, in stuff they released today, says that Tony Blair took the decision to go to war in Iraq because he fell in love with George Bush, and describes David Cameron as the most facile, superficial prime minister there's ever been.
This is the guy who was snorting coke off the hooker's breast,
yes,
who said this?
Yes.
In response to the charges that he was snorting coke?
No, this is in more stuff that the Sun published today. That this is what they caught him saying.
On the video?
Yes, on video.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Oh, my. Well, you know, cocaine does loosen the tongue.
It certainly did.
Apparently.
It most certainly did. Also today, as you know, New York Magazine released a groundbreaking new cover featuring 35 victims of alleged assaults from Bill Cosby.
Yes. Yeah, this is going to make it, I think, much, much more difficult for Mr. Cosby to recover his reputation. It's just so sad. The whole thing is so sad.
Very much so.
Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and brought to you by thisrealvote.com. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Victoria. Real quick, is there really a lion on the loose in Milwaukee?
I think so.
Yes? You think so? Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 6 minutes past the hour. Hillary Clinton released a video, basically a three-minute web ad. It's YouTube. And I'm on her mailing list now. I went over to HillaryClinton.com and signed up. And I was really impressed by this. And, you know, there's a very good chance. It's, at this moment, a probability, but as time goes on, a possibility, whatever you want to call it, that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee for president. And if so, I intend to do everything I can to make sure she gets elected. The Supreme Court is at stake. I may have, just like I have, you know, very specific disagreements with Barack Obama, President Obama, on some of his policies, I have some very specific disagreements with Hillary on some of her policies. But that doesn't mean that you don't vote for them. It doesn't mean you don't work for them. It doesn't mean you don't try to help them, you know, because the big picture is so much more important. And the Supreme Court is the biggest piece of the big picture. So anyhow, one of the most consequential issues of our time right now is global warming. And I, this morning, was reading one of my very favorite, and I use the word favorite advisedly because every time I read it, it scares the hell out of me. But I think it's one of the very best blogs out there for science geeks about global warming. And it's arctic-news.blogspot.com. And it's a blog where a bunch of basically Arctic weather scientists post the latest, you know, news and science and stuff like that. It's really quite remarkable. I strongly recommend that you check this out, arctic-news.blogspot.com. And the most recent post, and I think this was by Sam Corinna. I could be wrong. I printed it out, and it doesn't say, in the printout, it doesn't say who it was. But the title is Arctic Ocean Temperatures Keep Rising. 93% of all global warming goes right into the oceans. And that's the really scary bad news. Because the oceans are what are keeping all those methane clathrate crystals, that frozen methane under the ocean surface. And that warming is damn scary stuff. So anyhow, this post points out 93% of the heat goes into the ocean. So what does that mean? Well, the 20th century average for June, the entire century, from 1900 till 2000, the average ocean temperature was 61.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 16.4 degrees Celsius. In June of 2015, it was 1.57 degrees Fahrenheit higher. Now, whoever wrote this post says there have been times when it was warmer. The last time when it was warmer than today, during the E-E-M-I-A-N, and I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Eemian period, which I don't know much about. I've got some homework for myself here for this afternoon. The peak temperature was only a few tenths of a degree higher than today, according to the IPCC. In those days, there was a huge melting, accompanied by extreme storms and sea levels that were 5 to 9 meters higher than today. In many ways, the situation now already looks worse than it was in the Eemian, or however you say that, era. And maybe one of you is a climate scientist, and you can call in and inform me, you know, what is the Eemian? Why should I care? What does it matter? What was it all about? But here's where it gets really scary. There's a graph here that shows, you know, if we stay on this course, this is where we end up, right? A polynomial trend for the Arctic shows temperature anomalies of over 4 degrees Celsius. Now, this is just in the Arctic. This is not worldwide, but the Arctic is where there's something like 9, I don't remember if it was billion or trillion. There is more carbon locked up in the Arctic in the form of methane than there is in the entire atmosphere. And if that stuff melts, we are like heading right for the Permian mass extinction. So back to this. A polynomial trend for the Arctic shows temperature anomalies of over 4 degrees Celsius by 2020. That's 5 years from now. 6 degrees Celsius by 2030. That's 15 years from now. And 15 degrees Celsius by 2050. Which is 35 years from now. This is really, seriously dangerous stuff. And they note, threatening to cause major feedbacks to kick in include albedo changes and methane releases that would trigger runaway global warming and look set to eventually catch up with accelerated warming in the Arctic and result in global temperature anomalies of 16 degrees Celsius by 2052. That's more than the Permian mass extinction. So anyway, here is the clip that Hillary Clinton released about, you know, something we can do about this. Here it is.
Future generations will look back and wonder, what were we thinking? How could we possibly be so irresponsible? I'm just a grandmother with two eyes and a brain, and I know what's happening in the world is going to have a big effect on my daughter and especially on my granddaughter. It's hard to believe there are people running for president who still refuse to accept the settled science of climate change, who would rather remind us they're not scientists than listen to those who are. You don't have to be a scientist to take on this urgent challenge that threatens us all. You just have to be willing to act. America has made a start in addressing this threat. The renewable energy industry prevents as many as 70,000 asthma attacks and 3,000 premature deaths each year. It created over 50,000 new jobs and drove more than $35 billion in investment last year alone. But we have to do much more, and we have to do it now. On day one as president, I will set two ambitious national goals that will test our capacities, but that I know are within our reach. First, I will ensure we hit a target of having more than 500 million solar panels installed across the country by the end of my first term. Second, we'll set a 10-year goal of generating enough renewable energy to power every single home in America. Over the next few months, I will lay out a comprehensive agenda to meet the climate challenge and make America the world's clean energy superpower. We're all going to have to do our part. But that's who we are as Americans. We don't hide from change. We harness it.
That's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And I'm not going to damn her with faint praise. I'm not going to say, but I would have gone. No. I think that, you know, to hear, I wish President Obama would talk like this. I mean, he could be talking about this right now. Instead, he's still debating whether or not to allow Keystone XL as they continue construction of the damn thing. So, you know, And contrast that with every single, as far as I know, I mean, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe Donald Trump is not a climate denier. I'm not sure. I know that he has been on the record in the past saying he's in favor of a national health care system, that he disagrees with the Republicans on that. I mean, there was a piece over on Alternet that went up on, I think, on Saturday. My recollection is it was Zed Jelani, and it was titled The Surprising Progressive Case for Donald Trump. Well, I can tell you, Donald Trump is no progressive. Donald Trump is a billionaire. And his interests are going to be with the billionaire party, or the billionaire class, rather, particularly the conservative billionaire class. But the bottom line here is the entire Republican field, as far as I know, is in denial about what it's already happening in the Arctic, and it's affecting our weather. It's why we had such horrible winters 2 years in a row, why we had the hottest, last year was the hottest year in the history of the human race.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is truly important stuff. And to have somebody of the stature of Hillary Clinton speaking out like this so bluntly, really, I'm so pleased. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour, and Leon watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hey, Leon, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing? Good. Great show, Tom. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
Apparently, you are getting to be one of the few left of the lone liberal voices in this Republican-led mess that we're in. I don't know if you you did watch that Chuck Todd. Bernie just handled all of Chuck's talking points, and it's such as gotcha politics.
Yeah.
And he tried to, he brought up the 41-year-old essay on his on sexuality, you know, and Bernie just deflected that and said, "Listen, let's talk about something not 40, you know, present day and not 40 years old." And so Chuck Todd kept, but
right.
And Bernie just handled it great.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, but I don't know if you noticed that now that Chuck Todd is basically taking over for Ed Schultz.
Yeah. That's my understanding.
MSNBC has gone the corporate way. So you are the last lone liberal in the airways.
Well, it's not me. It's really... there's a bunch of us on Free Speech TV, and you know, we've got a great television network here. Free Speech TV, in my opinion, needs the next step for Free Speech TV is to, you know, they've got great satellite carriage. Free Speech TV is both on Dish and Direct, and they're on some cable systems around the country. In Burlington, Vermont, for example, Free Speech TV is on the cable system there. They're on the cable system they're on cable systems in Washington State, in Oregon, a couple of them in California. But what they really need to do, the next step needs to be to cut a deal with the big cable providers, you know, Comcast, Time Warner, and get national cable coverage so that, you know, people who are watching MSNBC and looking for an alternative can go to Free Speech TV. And that's that's going to take some money, and that's why we all have to support Free Speech TV.
Exactly. I'm a longtime supporter and listener. But then Ed Schultz and Cenk Uygur and Keith Olbermann, you know, all those people who are disaffected, they need to all join together, and we get a progressive media so we could band together, you know, and fight against Fox, you know. Free speech television is great. I just wish that we could get a little more funding. Well, or else I know maybe you could be, when Bernie gets elected, you could be either the chief of staff or the media.
No, I'm gonna keep doing what I'm doing, Leon. I have no desire to work inside the White House. I've been there. I remember when President Obama was first elected, and I was invited to the White House for a briefing by one of the top economists inside the White House. And this guy was giving us this big sales pitch for free trade, and I stood up and argued with him in front of a bunch of other reporters, and that was the last time they invited me. I just, you know, it's not. I am too outspoken for that world. I'm sorry.
Sure. Well, I just think, I mean, we had it. We thought we, you know, when you had Air America, I mean, it wasn't set up very well, you know. But
well, it was, you know, there was no billionaire behind Air America in a real consequential way, which is the sad thing. Rupert Murdoch lost $500 million on Fox before it started making money. And Air America lost, I think, $16 million. So their sin was that they were undercapitalized. Leon, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And very interesting. Trump filed a $5 billion, this is Soryang's over in the chat room, filed a $5 billion defamation lawsuit against Timothy O'Brien for estimating his net worth at between $150 and $250 million. Oh, my. But the comment in the chat room that I wanted to point out, and I got to find it here, because I want to attribute the person who said it. Ah, yeah, it was McWeber, MCWBR. Says Tom is right. Delaying the debates hurts Clinton more than it helps her. This is, I think this is actually a substantial issue. Is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the Democratic of the DNC, has yet to come up with specific dates for Democratic debates, and I think that if we had a Democratic debate the day after the Republican debate next week on Fox so-called news. Only the Democratic debate wasn't on Fox so-called news. It was someplace else, say on CNN or MSNBC. Then we would give Americans an opportunity to see how crazy the Republicans are and how sane the Democrats are. And because, you know, basically, I mean, you know, the debate on the Democratic side isn't do we strengthen Social Security? It's how much do we strengthen it and how rapidly? It's not do we you know, make Medicare more bulletproof? It's how do we do it and how rapidly? It's not do we raise the minimum wage? It's how much and how fast. It's not do we stop global warming or not? It's, again, how much and how fast. So the contrast between Democrats and Republicans is absolutely vivid. And the chairwoman of the Democratic National Convention, the Democratic Party, the institutional Democratic Party, I think is making a huge mistake by not scheduling Democratic debates to follow Republican debates so that everybody in the country can see what that contrast is. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, in my mind, and I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so, is so intent on protecting Hillary Clinton that that she's, you know, moving the debates off into the distance, the idea being that, you know, Bernie might beat Hillary in the debate. Well, you know, I'm telling you, I don't think that it's going to be a matter of Bernie beats Hillary or Martin O'Malley beats Hillary or Hillary puts her foot in her mouth. Hillary Clinton is a very, very good campaigner, and she's been through this rodeo before. She knows what she's doing. She's a very smart woman. She's got solid policy positions. You don't have to protect her, Debbie, or Congresswoman. You don't have to protect her. And by pushing back these debates, I think that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democratic Party are actually hurting the Democratic Party. Not to mention, you know, political dialogue in America. But that's just my opinion, and obviously the Democratic Party does not have any interest in my opinion. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tommy, I agree with you 100%. The lion apparently is still on the loose in Milwaukee. And one other thing is we do have to get behind Hillary 100% if she is the nominee.
You're right.
You are exactly right. There's the big picture on hand. But, you know, that being said, I'm not a fan of Wasserman Schultz either. And I think she may have cost the Democrats Congress and Senate seats in the last election because, you know, just like the one in Tennessee, I can't think of her name right now, but she ran away.
Alison Lundergan Grimes. Yeah. Yeah, she kept trying to be a conservadem. Alison Lundergan Grimes is actually more progressive than she portrayed herself in her ads because she thought that she could get the swing voters. I'm sorry, there's no such thing as a swing voter. You either turn out your base or you don't.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Anyways, you know, here's my thought, too, is I got a couple thoughts here I'd like to run by here. Could Bernie possibly just toss out a challenge to Hillary if Wasserman Schultz doesn't want to do this for a debate? And also, you know, since Fox Infotainment is hosting the Republican debate, could Free Speech possibly host a debate between Bernie and Hillary?
I'm sure Free Speech would be pleased to, and I know that Bernie would love to debate Hillary, but it has to be, I think Bernie is very committed right now to the Democratic Party and to going with the party, you know, what the party wants. And so his trying to go around Debbie Wasserman Schultz like that by calling a press conference and throwing down the gauntlet to Hillary would be not that different from Ted Cruz saying that Mitch McConnell lied to his face. I mean, it would be a real big foot in the mouth kind of thing in the party. So I think it would hurt him more than it would help him because she's not going to. First of all, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to do what she's going to do, and she's not going to change just because Bernie said to. And secondly, Hillary isn't going to debate him in a venue that is not sanctioned by the Democratic Party. So, I understand where you're coming from, Steve, and I'm making the same argument, that we need to have these Democratic debates now, and not because we need to pick our candidate, but because we need to show the American people the difference between the Democratic Party and its priorities and the Republican Party and its priorities. It's very, very simple stuff. And
totally. Otherwise, the people just get the corporatist line, and it just hangs out there.
That's right.
One last thing I wanted to mention to you. You brought about Trump suing. Who is he suing now again?
There was some guy who said he wasn't worth as much money as he's worth. They got thrown out.
Yeah. Well, he's always suing somebody. You remember about a couple years ago, Bill Maher did a piece on him on his hair and alluding to an orangutan. he sued Bill Maher for $5 million, too, remember?
I didn't know that. No, I don't. I didn't remember. I know that,
check it out.
There used to be a regular segment on David Letterman's show. You know, it was called Trump or Monkey Hair, where they would bring some poor person in off the street. Yeah, but those have been all scrubbed off the internet. I wonder if that was the result of another Trump lawsuit.
Oh, jeez. Well, thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate everything, and have a good week here.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Thanks for calling, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. It is it's great to hear from you. We're going to hit a break here in about 10 seconds, and I'll continue picking up your calls on Anything Goes Summer. So stick around. It is actually, it won't be. I'm sorry. I missed my break. Is this? Oh, we're at the bottom of the hour. Okay, my clock is off. We'll be back. We're coming up at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with your calls and Anything Goes Summer here in the Tom Hartman Program right after the news at the bottom of the hour. Take it back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Anything Goes Summer, as they say. Oh, hang on just a second here. There was another comment in the chat room. Thank you, Sue, for this. The Emian, also the Sangamonian, the Ipswichian, the McCulkin, the not as in the kid, the actor. Only one K in it. The Kadaki, the Valdivia, and the Risvurm was the interglacial period. That would be a warm era between two glacial periods, two ice ages, which began about 130,000 years ago and ended about 115,000 years ago. Thank you for that. I was wondering. So apparently there was not a mass extinction associated with it. It was simply, you know, one of those cyclical changes when the oceans were 9 yards higher than today. And the ocean was about the same temperature as it is today. All not good stuff. Joseph in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Joseph, what's on your mind today?
Let me take you off the speaker.
Thank you.
Tom, I want to talk to you about Tag You're It.
Okay.
I first started listening to you when I discovered AM 1090 in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And because of Tag You're It, I caucused with the Democrats in 2008. And fast forward to today, last week, Friday, I checked in with Bernie Sanders and said, and looking for a local meeting for the Wednesday event.
Mm-hmm.
And all around me, they were full up.
Ouch.
So I said, well, maybe I'm not too late. I'll sign up to host one.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I'm all full up, and
wow.
There are, when I first looked and started looking on Friday, there were about 45 events in a 20-mile radius. There are now 65.
Wow.
And they're all filling up at the same rate as mine.
Yeah, that's what I noticed when I went to BernieSanders.com and plugged in my zip code, which is 20024, and I was just looking at it going, whoa, you know, the closest one to me is full. I haven't looked in the last couple of days, but, I mean, this was like last Friday I was looking at them. So.
Well, that's when you were looking, what is what prompted me to go ahead and check.
So are you hosting this in your home, Joseph?
Yes, I am.
Good on you. That is great. That is great.
Well, this is, you know, this is, like I said, fast forward. I mean, Murray and Cantwell are on speed dial, as is Adam Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hosting a Bernie event on Wednesday, and I am inviting 20 strangers into my home, and our only connection is Bernie.
That's fascinating. Would you call us later in the week? You know, it's Wednesday this week, right? It's day after tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah. So give us a call on Thursday or Friday and let us know how it went.
Oh, Sure, I will, absolutely.
Great. We'll change our you may only call once a week rule. So you can call back in because I'm curious how it goes. Joseph, thank you for the call and thanks for taking picking up the mantle and running with it for being it.
It's the only way we are going to elect him is we don't have money. We have people.
Yeah, I agree. It's also the ultimate antidote to depression and cynicism, doing something. And so, yeah, I'm with you.
You're absolutely right, because before I got active, I was really down on the whole system. It's like there's no hope. And I am totally rejuvenated because and I'm Bernie's age, by the way.
That's great. That is great.
And when he said he was in, I am.
Yeah.
It's like I have something to do.
Yeah, it's a marvelous thing. Joseph, I got to move along, but thank you for the call, and I look forward to hearing your report back at the end of the week. Thank you for the call. Fred in Silver City, New Mexico. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's an honor talking to you.
Thank you.
I'm a big Bernie fan, and I would like to say that, as Bernie says, he doesn't need a movement. He needs a revolution.
Yes.
In any consequential situation like a revolution, a war, an election, you need a theme song. Bernie's theme song, ironically, should be Revolution by the Beatles. The first line of that song is, yeah, you say you want a revolution? Yeah, we'd all love to change the world.
Yeah.
Very succinct, very powerful.
Yeah. It really was. It was sort of an anti-weatherman song also, though, but when you start talking about guns, you lost me, basically, is I forget the exact words.
I understand. I can see the revolution song with those first two lines being very big, very powerful. You could even have 10-second spots where artists, both young and old, come out and sing those two lines and then say, revolt and vote.
Right.
Make mine Bernie.
Right. Revolution at the ballot box. Say you want a revolution. Oh, I can't sing. So anyway, Fred, thank you for that. That's a great suggestion. Thank you. Jill in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Jill. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Thanks for bringing up the global warming issue again. You are great at that. And thanks for putting on the clip of Hillary Clinton's concern. That's why she's my number two candidate for the presidency.
Same here.
Now, on the other hand, President Bernie Sanders, oops, I kind of like the way that sounded, has been talking about global warming for a very, very long time and always brings it up in every town meeting.
Yeah.
Now, as a side note, Bernie Sanders has been working for civil rights and black lives since and probably before. He was at the Martin Luther King speech way back in the 60s.
Yeah, that was 63. He was arrested in 62 at the University of Chicago trying to integrate housing there.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just had to push for Bernie, and I can't wait for Wednesday. I met a very nice gal who I think we will be friends.
Great. Okay. Jill, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric.
When you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
That was the line.
In there.
There you go.
Hey,
thank you, Eric.
And your caller there being rejuvenated, yeah, absolutely getting involved with that. So I think we need some new T-shirts. The vitamin B complex. Source for apathy.
Vitamin B complex.
My reason, get Bernie to, the guy of his years, puttering around with more juice than most kids a third of his age.
Yep.
So they got to get themselves some vitamin D for Bernie.
There you go.
I'm actually calling because of the odd loop you're doing today. You don't have your normal, best of the rest of the news. You're doing a thing on unequal protection, which is a sentimental favorite for mine. I wanted to give you an end to your day here with something kind of upbeat that it actually can be done, and it doesn't have to be someone like, Susan Anthony or anyone like that from days of yore. I have a 21st century example of how you can fight back and win. I'm a guy, I've called you before, I've mentioned this lawsuit of mine. I'm always careful to not plug it too much, but I actually made law with prosecuting it, brought it before the highest appeals court in New York, And what it did was, I don't know if you're familiar, Tom, but in New York, up until October of 2013, when Landon v. Kroll became law, prior to that, by virtue of being a third-party actor, you were immune, untouchable from claims. And my corporate defendant now, that I'm going to be taking to trial, they were, you know, cutting a corner to save a buck, and they didn't have a direct relationship with me. It was, you know, through the connect of the probation department, and I was able to persuade the court to see that third-party actor as directly and instrumentally involved enough in what was the cause of civil injury that they said, you know what? It's time to open the door to third-party actors.
That is great. So basically, hiring a company as a subcontractor does not insulate that company.
Not anymore. Not in New York.
That is great.
Where it still happens. And by the way, Tom, this is the business of business consulting now.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Eric, good on you. And thank you for the thanks for the call and thanks for sharing that story. That is great news. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob. The crash?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You hear me?
I do.
Okay. What no one has realized, and you're seeing it, and they only talk about West Texas Intermediate and IMEX Oil. No one will talk about the fact that as soon as the real estate crash happened, every single commodity went up almost quadruple. A 30-year chart will show you that whether it's oil, rice, corn,
yeah,
for 30 years.
It's because people, it's because big institutional investors were moving their money. They were looking for places to put their money.
Out of mortgages and into it. What happened is in 2013, they've reached another peak in all commodities. People should pay attention. I will give everybody, if they want to check commodities for themselves, Index Mundi.
Mm-hmm.
It'll give you 30-year charts, and
yeah,
you can look them up. But we've had a crash in the last 6 months that's taken every commodity down by 50% or more.
Right.
It would be considered a crash.
I agree. And that was my point in the first hour, is I think this presages a stock market crash, although what it's going to do is it's going to inflate other bubbles in other places over the short term. And that's why it makes the crash so much worse. But excellent point, Bob. I got some of my notes off TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com, as I recall. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Denise, watching Free Speech TV in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that there was this article in The Nation magazine,
mm-hmm,
and it said, my friends told me that it said that the Koch brothers sent Bernie a check, but he's sending it back, so kudos to Bernie for not taking corporate money.
Wow, I didn't know about that. That's, if true, that's impressive.
Well, they're going to give me the article this week when I see them, because I couldn't believe it either, but if the Koch brothers are sending him money, it's probably just some kind of a trick.
I think the Nation is online. I think it's thenation.com. You should be able to find it online.
Yeah, I'll get on the computer. Yeah. Also, we switched from Wells Fargo and sent Bernie our money after we got into a credit union. Thank you for all your talking about big banks.
Yeah, yeah. Credit unions are a really good alternative to being, A, supporting the big banks, and B, being vulnerable to the big banks. Because if they go down, they will take a lot of people with them. So,
and we love our Bernie Bear.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. So it arrived.
And Unequal Protection. My husband's reading it right now. You're a great writer.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Denise. A lot of work went into that book. It's nice to hear that kind of feedback. I really appreciate it. I got to move along. Denise, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech. Hannah in Pinehurst, Idaho. Hey, Hannah, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You had mentioned earlier about how corporations sometimes function as monopolies, and essentially they're all really owned by the same people, where their CEOs are just yes men for their board of directors who are their shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious what your thoughts are, because I've noticed this a lot in the industry that I work in. When we talk about fighting big money, maybe we need to apply a little further root cause analysis and look at the people who are actually running these companies, not the CEOs, but the people that own them.
Mm-hmm.
Basically tell the CEOs what to do.
There's an amazing website, Hannah, that you would just love. It's called theyrule.net. theyrule.net. And on that website, you can look up, you plug in a corporation's, a publicly traded corporation's name, and they've got a list. And it'll show you everybody who's on the board of directors. And then you can bring up another corporation and put them, and it's all visual. You can put up another corporation and show the board of directors and then ask, what are the links between the two? And you'll see that Corporation A has the same person on the board. Say you're trying to go from Corporation A to Corporation D. Corporation A and Corporation B have the same person on their board of directors. Corporation B then has the same person on the board of directors with Corporation C. Corporation C has the same person. We're talking different people here, but the same, you know, it shares a person between C and D. And so now you've got this causal line between A and D. I did this for, I think it was 100 corporations, the top 100 corporations in my book on equal protection. And I used this website, theyrule.net, and you can literally start at Coca-Cola and end at Coca-Cola, or start at AT&T and end at AT&T. It goes through all these corporations, and they're all linked to each other.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's a little frightening. And many times they're old politicians, they're retired politicians. You find a lot of that, and people in the defense industry, the banksters. It's really shocking. So check it out. I'm assuming it's still up. It's been probably 6 months since I've looked at it, but it's theyrule, theyrule.net. Hannah, thanks a lot for the call, and have a great day. We will be, and thank you for watching Free Speech. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Louisiana, in Covington, Louisiana. Hey, Jim, what's up?
I went and saw Bernie last night.
Really?
I didn't expect him to be there. I thought it was going to be a feed, you know, some sort of video feed or something. And then a lady talked for about a minute or two. And then next thing I know, there's Bernie on the stage. And there's about 1,000 people. The place was packed.
Wow. What town was this?
Kenner, Louisiana.
Wow. How big is that town?
It's outside of New Orleans. It's basically a suburb of New Orleans.
Okay. That's great.
And I didn't expect to see him. And, you know, he gave his basic stump speech, but, I mean, he's, you know, hitting his talking points. And I'm not criticizing him because that's what, you know, you got to do that to some extent.
Yeah.
But to me, he's just light years ahead of Hillary. I that, you know, that's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
And I've been contributing. I signed up for $10 a month, sending to Bernie, and man, I hope he wins. I've been a fan of Bernie's since I've been listening to him like 8-9 years, and since I got serious. And I have yet to find
another politician. We have put out invitations to other politicians to come on this program and take unfiltered calls from our listeners for an hour. And, I mean, the only screening that we do is for people who are drunk or abusive. You know, if somebody calls up and starts swearing, they're not going to go on the air. And if somebody calls up and can't speak, you know, if they sound like they're drunk, they don't go on the air. But other than that, you know, Bernie pretty much is taking calls in the order that they come in. And, you know, he's been doing it for a decade now, for 10 years on this program. You know, there may be other politicians out there who would be willing to do it, but I have not run across them. I'm really impressed by him. I'm so glad to hear that he got down into Louisiana. It's like, why is this not in the news? If Donald Trump drew 1,000 people to anywhere, it would be front page news. If Rick Perry, if Scott Walker, if any of the Republicans were able to draw 1,000 people into it, particularly into a small town in the South, it would be all over the news. It would be a huge big deal. Instead, you know, these Republicans are pulling, you know, 50 people, 100 people, 150 people, and nobody talks about it. Jim, thank you for that. Thank you for the update. David in Los Angeles. Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, hi. I was calling about access to your show on TV.
Uh-huh.
And I've been getting it through Roku. I just added it to my feed, and it's a lot easier. I don't have cable or anything, so it's just an easy way to watch your show and add it to my Roku feed.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Free Speech TV has a Roku app. Louise and I have a Roku box. And
yeah, me too. I love having it. I didn't know it was there. I just added it, and it's great. And you don't bypass the cable stuff, and it's very good. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. David, thanks for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Los Angeles via Roku. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have to thank you for waking me up. You put a little salt in a wound that was happened a while back, and that was the last election. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, Debbie Wasserman Schultz got trounced. As a chair for the Democratic Party, that was a major failure when we lost the Senate, and the main reason that I extrapolated from it was that they were running away from Obama's winning record. And whether Obama was – whether they had the slander machine on President Obama, and they thought that was a liability, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that he's had a pretty good record up until – with me up until this Trans-Pacific Partnership and a few other he didn't support the unions as much as he should.
Yeah.
But I think it's time to ask for Debbie Wasserman Schultz's resignation, and she shows the same aptitude – coming up to this election as she showed in the last one. And I'd like to see a change.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a close observer of the DNC and its activities, and I can't comment on whether Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been a good steward of the organization, other than to say that I think that she and or I doubt that she's, you know, that she's like, you know, the dictator of the DNC. So this is probably not just her decision to make. It's probably a committee decision. But I think that the DNC institutionally, by saying we're not even going to talk about what dates we're going to have debates, while the Republicans are out there getting their message out to the American people, deceptive as it is, they're doing it. And the Democrats are invisible. I think it's a huge, huge mistake. I wouldn't call for her to step down, but I would call for the entire DNC to pay some attention to this. This is a big issue. Randy, thanks for the call. Harry in Chicago, you've got a theory on Donald Trump and Scott Walker. My piece on that, my conspiracy piece, complete with links, is over at alternate.org right now. Yeah.
Yes, I kind of disagree, but I got my own take on that. My theory is this, is that Trump and the other senator that disagreed with Mitch McConnell, they called him a lie?
Oh, yeah, Ted Cruz.
Cruz, yes. And I believe that those two have set out to help to destroy the Republican Party. I believe they've gotten in a hurry so that then they can come in and take over.
It could be. I
believe they're tired of waiting because they see they're not going to win, I believe.
I think you could more effectively argue that the Koch brothers and a few other of their billionaire buddies, you know, Sheldon Adelson and a few of these other guys who basically have taken control of the Republican Party or pieces of it, are the ones who are destroying the Republican Party. But right. I don't disagree with your point. Time?
But I believe they're trying to accelerate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Enjoy your show, Tom.
Thank you, Harry. Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening to WCPT there in Chicago. It's a great independent station that we are so pleased to be on, and a great show following ours, by the way. So, anyhow, this is a very critical moment in the history of the United States, and it's one that we can't afford to just sit around, sit on our hands, complain. You know, none of that stuff is going to work. What's going to work? What's going to help move our country forward and frankly save the planet is if you and I get active, genuinely active, and make things happen, make good progressive things happen in this country once again. So tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.